This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Our walk through Michael Gray's amazing Song and Dance Man Volume 2 continues with a chat with Michael about the groom still waiting at the altar and Angelina. These are covered in Chapter 4 of the book, along with Caribbean Wind. As with Every Grain of Sand, which we discussed in a previous episode, Michael is selecting key and interesting songs and performances from this period, the early 80s, which in some typical and some unique ways represent the work that Dylan was producing. Our conversation here includes several passages from this chapter read by Michael himself. Groom Still Waiting at the Altar is a forceful and energetic song, stuffed with words and not necessarily clarity. It exists in several substantially different studio and live versions, and has been covered successfully too. We'll talk about all of that, and in the show notes you can find links to a playlist that brings all these versions and covers together for you to enjoy, and perhaps listen to before or after this podcast. Before we dig into the discussion, I want to mention that even more than in most episodes from this series and our conversations with Michael, the discussion here covers issues that surround or lie behind the text in the book. And to state the obvious, this is some kind of commentary track to the chapters. It's not the core work itself. In the actual text, Michael relentlessly examines these songs and uncovers the lyrics and Dylan's techniques. I'm saying this because I'm a little disappointed in how little of this analysis we're actually able to fit into these discussions. And while I hope you find these talks interesting and fun, even if you haven't read the book, I want to stress, yet again, that these are in no way a substitute for the actual book itself. To prove this point, here's a bonus passage in which Michael talks about the song Angelina. We didn't get to discuss this passage in the episode, but I want to play it as an example of the kind of examination of Dylan's lyrics that fill literally every page in Song and Dance Man.
The declaration that there is such a journey comes at the start of the second verse with the deft line, "Blood drying in my yellow hair as I go from shore to shore." This sets the tone. It establishes the vague generality, the grand sweep of the song's journey, and simultaneously supplies those specific details, the blood drying in the yellow hair, details which, far from clarifying, only serve to clinch how little we are to be left to feel we know. The yellow hair tells us that the narrator's persona isn't Bob Dylan. The blood drying, while detailed, is wholly unexplained. The line that follows, "I know what it is that has drawn me to your door," only serves to tell us that we don't know what it is, after which comes an immediate confession that much is unknown to the singer, too. "But whatever could it be makes you think you've seen me before, Angelina." We don't know either whether Angelina is right or wrong in thinking this. We don't even know if the singer knows whether she's right or wrong.
A lot of us listen to Dylan because of what and how the songs make us think. And what I find so enjoyable about these books is how absolutely stuffed the pages are with smart and convincing analysis and context. That, at least for me, make songs that I've heard thousands of times almost new again.
You're listening to our public feed, which includes only a portion of this conversation. To hear the complete discussion, become an FM Plus subscriber, sign up in Apple Podcasts, or see the show notes for details.
Now, here's our talk with Michael Gray on The Groom Still Waiting at the Altar and Angelina. Michael, welcome back. We're at Chapter 4.
Yeah.
So the middle of volume two, volume one, you showed us, or chapter one of volume two, I should say, we saw this somewhat subtle, sneaky to some of us, shift towards gospel in Street Legal. Yeah. Then we looked at Yonder Comes Sin and what you kind of described as the first softening of the fundamentalism. And then we looked at the phenomenal Every Grain of Sand and talked about, well, a lot of things, but one is, you know, what kind of doubt is in there and what else is in there. You continue on in chapter four, looking at songs, and you squeeze three of them in here, although the chapter is called Groom Still Waiting at the Altar. You start with something that isn't always your specialty, which is, I'll call it Bob Dylan trivia, but I did not know this, the fact that Groom Still Waiting at the Altar was not on the first version of this album. How long after it came out was the change made?
I can't remember, but it was quite a while. I mean, when Shot of Love came out, it just wasn't there. It's the most unusual thing for the record company to do, or for Bob to agree to, if he did, to add in a track later that was rejected at the time. The sessions for that album produced many things that were rejected and which I focus on in this book as being particularly good tracks, you know. Groom's Still Waiting at the Altar. I'm not surprised from a marketing point of view that this was eventually put back into the album, other than that that's not what you expect to happen with Bob Dylan albums. You know, I mean, they didn't go back later. They didn't go back to Infidels and squeeze in Blind Willie McTell. Anyway, it happened, and it's one of the fine tracks on Shot of Love. Surely, certainly better than something as tedious as I'll Remember You.
Well, I'm gonna have to go first of all find a vinyl copy of the the first edition without the song, and figure out when they did that. You do wonder if it was a commercial. I mean, you would have to be a commercial, you know, desire. It seems less likely an artistic, I left a line in the story out that I wanted to include, especially after a long time. Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah. But in any case, it is a fantastic song. And listening to all the versions and thinking about it, you know, one thing that struck me, especially as we get into the meaning and the context and the analysis we're about to, is like Every Grain of Sand, it's just an appealing sounding record. The circus sound kind of connection to, Rainy Day Women. It's not exactly that boisterous, but it's just this sort of fun chugging along.
That chugging thing, yes. Yes.
Yeah. And even, you know, and I think a lot of people like a lot of Bob songs, I mean, certainly at least outside of the hardcores, you know, the title, if not just the chorus, is probably the only thing they catch. And there's just some jumble of words going on between. And yet it's just remarkably likable. You know, even in that state.
I like that, some jumble of words going on in the meantime. Yes, well, of course, some people listen to music like that. You know, they don't they don't register the words. And in a way, when I was young, I didn't either. I mean, when I think back now to how poor and unsubtle the lyrics were of records that I loved as a teenager, you know, what was I thinking? I mean, I wasn't thinking about the words. I was thinking about the whole thing as a whole thing. You know, it was the excitement of the music and what label it was on. But words about I Love You, Please Be True were not what registered with me. Even though, of course, they did in a way, because they were, the vocalist sound was part of the sound. And so, yeah, I can understand why someone can listen to Groom Still Waiting at the Altar without ever really paying any attention to all those words. And I mean, you know, there are so many. Why even question what the title means or where that comes from, you know? But if you do, then there's an extra layer of resonance there, because, it was John the Baptist who made this analogy that the groom was Christ and the bride was the church. You know, he comes along and says, I'm not the bridegroom, I'm just the friend of the bride.
Well, and that's exactly what this chapter does. And in the, you know, you start, as you just did, by putting the biblical context onto a song that I think, I'm only assuming, many, many people would never know and catch. And, you know, Shot of Love as the third Born Again album, if you will, always feels like a stretch to me. I mean, you know, we've got Every Grain of Sand and things like that on it, but compared to where we came from with Saved specifically, let alone...
Absolutely. It's a completely, on the face of it, it's a completely secular album compared to Saved. I mean, there's just no undiluted message in the way that Saved had one. And the tracks are quite varied, aren't they, on Shot of Love? I mean, Lenny Bruce, I mean, how does that... That's not part of a trilogy of gospel albums.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but which it happens to follow Property of Jesus, though. So there's certainly some there.
Yeah. I like Property of Jesus. That's quite a rocky song.
You know, back to this idea of how much attention to focus on the words, you know, there's extremes, right? There's people who say they don't listen to the words. Actually, I was listening to, there's a great podcast called My Favorite Album. And I was catching up on an older, not that old, but a couple months ago, episode about Street Legal this weekend. But the guy at some point says, yeah, I used to never listen. I would love this album, but you know, I didn't listen to the words at all. And it's, it's hard to imagine, but rather than condemning that or making fun of it, you know, as I go through these, even especially against the book, when I'm sort of close reading your book as I am to prepare for these, things constantly are popping out that just blurred by me between other lines. And I am a word listener primarily. I have to force myself sometimes.
Things still pop out at me that I had never noticed before. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there was one this morning that just came into my mind. A quirky line of his in some song. And I thought, I've never questioned that quirky line before. I've never picked up on it. But it's a great pleasure to me to do that, picking up on lines. I mean, obviously that's the whole thrust of the book. Although I would say that what was difficult in the first place when I was writing the book was how to deal with stuff that was not poetry on the page, but was music and voice. And those ingredients are there, of course. You know, when it comes to Angelina, a very confusing song to start with. I think I say in the book that the way into it is through the performance. It's not always a question of pulling the words away from the rest. I hope it's not that. But certainly I'm interested in the words, sure.
Yeah, and that I think that's the grandest thing the book does is lets many of us who either don't pay attention or couldn't find everything that's there in there. And now those lines, they get that from you, from the book, and then they're there as we listen going forward. So Groom Still Waiting the Altar, it has this carnival kind of sound. It has these, I wanted to say shouty, but not necessarily shouty lyrics, but they're certainly, you know, it's coming from deep within Bob and being pushed out forcefully. But you call it a craziness of vision and a tour de force performance. So we have that word performance again. It brings up, you know, I mean, among other things, Paul Williams is, you know, his view on Dylan, which is all that it's all the live performance. And it's that imbuing of the lyrics with whatever he puts out that kind of drives it.
I wouldn't argue with the idea that Bob Dylan is a performance artist at all. I mean, I would just say that, you know, the live performances are not the whole thing, that the studio recordings are crucial. Absolutely crucial.
As we get into the chapter here, and I want to start with a passage from the book where you are doing, you know, what you do best and really explaining to us what and how Dylan is putting across, is delivering the performance, and particularly with the vocal emphasis on the syllables, if you will, and creating these rhymes. So let's listen to a passage from early in the chapter.
The only solidly inevitable rhyme is, aptly, that of altar with Gibraltar. All the others are unpredictable, switching between the da-da and da-da-da line endings. To want me, and snobbery, for instances, occasionally pushed to a da-da-da-da, as in obligated, and ranging restlessly between the orderliness of order and border and the purring blur of to haunt me and to want me, between ragged half-rhymes like humiliated and obligated, pushing snatched raggedness to the limit in putting cement with innocent and nauseated with deteriorated, and the jokingly precise and splendid temperature and furniture, and between the simplicity of to leap it and to keep it, the tiny sneakiness of sent to me and meant to be, and the take a bow outrageousness of the last verse's last rhyme, the incomparable pairing of January with Buenos Aires.
One of the many revelations to me as I reread again this chapter was this first paragraph. And you talk about it evoking the bizarre grogginess of waking up and half knowing where you are, which is one of these situations where you kind of have to step back from a half line or a line and look at the whole verse and see what it is. That idea, the reference to waking up, when you hear it, you look at it, you go, yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, this face in the cement, heard a moan, saw a light, felt weird. It's very interesting. The word praying in the ghetto with my face in the cement, which is not a line that on its surface one could make a lot of literal sense of.
Yeah.
I almost wonder if praying was laying in the ghetto with my face in the cement or...
Well, yeah, I think that's the subtext there, yes. I mean, the line makes you picture him lying face down, not praying, just lying face down. And then, you know, the rest of that passage, he starts looking around, feeling confused and so on. I mean, the fact that he doesn't say waking up at the beginning of it is part of his brilliance, if you like. He doesn't need to tell you as crudely as that, you know. I mean, it's just like when, you know, way back with Hattie Carroll, he never tells you she's black. He makes it clear.
I will say, whether he needs to or he makes it clear, I'm admitting for myself, he hadn't. I didn't catch it. And when you pointed out, it's like, oh, wow. And then I still will give him credit for the inventiveness and the making it interesting to not do the obvious thing and to change it to praying, even if it's as subterfuge, is clever and interesting and fun. If nothing else, it gives me and maybe some of the other listeners the fun of discovering it later and now looking at this thing and going, oh, okay. Especially as a first verse in a song that is, you know, like some of the others that are in this chapter anyway, you know, Angelina and Caribbean Wind, that feel like cut and paste songs to a lot of people and there's not a clear narrative and hard to follow. Getting a thread to pull at the beginning here really helps. I love just starting and seeing something that is so new on something I've heard 1,000 times. And luckily it doesn't make me feel stupid. It just adds to the experience.
Well, you know, I think we all have that. We all have that. Why did I never think of that before? Experience listening to Dylan, because there's just so much of it. And you know, you hear it. You hear a line when you're 25, and you hear it when you're 75. I speak for myself here, and you know, you're going to hear it. You're going to hear it differently anyway, because you're coming from a different place. And it happens to me all the time. I wouldn't say all the time, but it happens over and over. I mean, I had, for instance, listened to "You're Going to Make Me Lonesome When You Go" hundreds of times before it ever occurred to me that "when you go" meant when you die, or could mean it. Not necessarily does mean it, but can have that meaning. I mean, you know, why did it take me hundreds of listens before I even thought that? I can be just as slow as anyone else, you know.
The other thing that happens here, to talk about the text, that, and you start earlier in the book, earlier in this chapter on this, You also paid attention to the fact that Bob singing on the studio released version doesn't follow his own lyrics from at the time writings and drawings and what we see now on the website, with substantial differences, key differences. There's now two or three other performances where he both goes back to the text, to the manuscripts more precisely, and interpolates anew.
Well, I think the songbooks, the official things like writings and drawings, they've always been very problematic because, I think sort of in the olden days, Bob used to write a lyric down, send it through to the music publisher, and then go into the studio and record something different, either very different or slightly different or something in between. But then the first collection, that Writings and Drawings, 1972, I think. So that certainly doesn't cover Joy of Love songs. It should have been the opportunity to get to a definitive text of each lyric. I mean, that's what a lyric book is for. The lyric, all it requires is for the lyrics to be correct. And then they're useful. And over again, they're not.
So we've got the Shot of Love version, the Trouble No More live version, and the Michael Bloomfield Box live version as, I think, official. I'll try to pull those together. I actually also made a playlist that I'll share that have the three I just mentioned, and I picked three or four covers that I thought were interesting.
I've only heard two. One of them I heard today as a result of stuff that you posted on social media. But a version that I heard from a recording a long time ago now, but which was pretty good, I thought, was the Rod Stewart version.
So you mentioned at the beginning that this was left off and that the Shot of Love Infidels period was the high water mark for leaving good songs off of albums for Bob. So we have Groom, we have Angelina, Caribbean Wind, Foot of Pride, and then of course Blind Willie McTell. Overall, and we've all heard the Bob's explanations and other thoughts about it. Why do you think that happened? Do you think there's a is it nonchalance? Is it capricious? Is it how do five masterpieces stay behind?
It's a hard question to answer, but it makes me remember that. When he was talking, maybe on No Direction Home. Anyway, at some point, he was talking about his first album. And he said that he had sort of deliberately not put all his best stuff out up front, that he had held good stuff back from that first album. Well, there is no one else who would have done that. Everyone else puts, their first album, for God's sake. You're going to put your best stuff on it, aren't you? But Bob, I think I'll keep some stuff up my sleeve, I'm not going to give everything out at once. And so maybe that's a strong feeling in him that.
That's all we have time for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this conversation, along with all of our other extended and bonus episodes, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or see the show notes for details. FM Plus subscribers get full access to every show on the FM Pods network, which includes Pod Dylan, Watching the Covers Flow, Gaucho Amigos, and more. Visit us at fmpods.com.
Did you enjoy this show? Then please rate this podcast and leave a review. It really helps. Also, sign up for 7 Days, our free weekly newsletter that puts all the top Bob Dylan news and links into your inbox every Sunday. Use the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening.